faces marked like this? She asked. That symbol means that monsters from any family may enter, Aaron said. This whole complex, the inn, the market, the post office, is a way station. Monsters from all families are welcome to come and go. A way station. Joan remembered the monsters who had arrived in the rain yesterday wearing clothes from different times. She pictured places like this dotted around the city. Safe places where monsters could travel in and out, unobserved by humans. Places to exchange currency and buy clothes, to meet people and relay messages, to eat and sleep. Aaron had already started walking toward the mouth of the laneway. Joan followed him. She felt as though she'd just glimpsed a whole bigger world. Outside, the remnants of the storm were all over the streets. Puddled water and stray sticks and leaves. Joan's self-consciousness about her clothes started to fade as she realised that no one was particularly looking at them, or at least, no more than people usually looked at Aaron. These clothes really did make them blend in more. "Thank you for taking me," she said to Aaron, a little awkwardly. "I know you don't believe we can change anything." "I know you have to do this," Aaron said. Joan was reminded of his weary expression from last night. Every monster goes up against the timeline.
What do you mean?
Everyone goes up against the timeline, Aaron said. Everyone tries to change something at some point. What had Aaron tried to change? When had he gone up against the timeline? What had happened that it made him so weary now? Joan wanted to ask him, but something in his expression silenced her. Just like yesterday, the 90s were everywhere. As they walked past newsstands, Joan glimpsed headlines. New disaster for John Major. Steffi poised to win Wimbledon. On the cover of Vogue, the model had heavy mascara and thin eyebrows. Aaron took the same kind of twisting route he'd taken to get to the Monster Inn, through parks and shops and churchyards. "This isn't a shortcut," Joan said slowly, when Aaron doubled back. "I'm avoiding security cameras," Aaron said. "Monsters don't like being captured on camera. There aren't as many in this time as in yours, but there are enough." Joan took that in. "The Hunts don't like being photographed either." Joan had always thought that was one of their eccentricities, but it seemed this was another thing that was cultural. Not long after that, Aaron turned into a narrow commercial street full of jewellers and bespoke shoemakers. If Joan were to guess, they were somewhere north of Covent Garden. He stopped halfway up the street. "The Lewes," he said. The shop, if that's what it was, had no signage, not even a street number. The front was just a cool wall of frosted glass bricks. Patches of violet and green shimmered beyond the glass like the dart of exotic fish. In the summer sunshine, the effect was almost tropical. As they stood there, a beautiful woman pushed past them, briefly enveloping them both in a scent that made Joan think of summer gardens. She pushed at the wall, and a piece of the glass moved inward. A door, its edges cunningly blended into the glass bricks. Joan caught a glimpse of vibrant colour. Then the door swung shut, and there was only the wall. "We need to be very careful," Aaron said. He had a relaxed hand in his pocket. But Joan was beginning to recognise his mannerisms now, and she could see the tense line of his back. "Nothing's free between families. If you want information from the Lewes, you'll have to trade for it."
"I have money," Joan said. "She'd sold the phone yesterday."
But Aaron was already shaking his head. "Something like this is considered a favour. It'll be a favour for a favour, and monsters take debt seriously. You'll have to pay what you owe."
"And after all this, what will I owe you?" Joan said.
Aaron's cheeks turned pink. I told you, I'm the one who's in your... Oh, will you stop asking questions so we can do this? He said with an exasperated tone that was becoming a familiar part of their conversations. Joan shrugged. She turned and pushed the wall where the woman had touched it. To her surprise, the door crashed open. She'd measured her effort for a heavy glass door, but in some genius of craftsmanship, it had been weighted to open to the lightest of touches. Joan's push had made it fly. She flushed, the violent entrance making her feel ridiculous. Distantly, she heard Aaron make a disapproving sound at her clumsiness, but she barely registered it as she stared around her. The space inside was huge, far larger than it had seemed from the street. Light streamed from skylights. More light shone through the glass brick wall, scattering into rainbows on the pale wooden floor. The layout was a crisscross of white walls. It took Joan a second to realize that they were strategically angled away from direct sunlight. The slashes of tropical colour that she'd seen from the outside were paintings, the streaky abstract kind that she'd always thought looked like children's finger paintings. But these weren't painted by children. Perhaps aided by the layout of the room, perhaps by careful placement and progression, these paintings were intensely compelling, raw and mysterious. Joan found herself walking closer. Just a few steps revealed a man, hidden by the angle of a wall. He was in profile, repositioning a painting, and he had Chinese features, handsome and grave. He looked up at Joan's approach.
Ying?
It was the woman who'd entered ahead of them. She was even more beautiful now that Joan could see her properly. She was perhaps 30, with flawless golden brown skin. Her face was as delicate as a doll's. She gave Joan a casual up and down look that dismissed her, and then reconsidered the dismissal. She tilted her head.
Daughter? She asked the man, Ying.
Niece. Ying's pause was long. She's not a Liu. Now that he was looking at Joan directly, she could see that his face was cut with deep, sad lines. His dark hair was parted perfectly and pulled back into a short ponytail. His clothing was both impeccable and slightly incongruous. Shirt collar as white and rigid as porcelain. Trousers a blue-grey linen that made Joan think of stormy seas. Joan felt Aaron appear beside her.
Excuse me, Aaron said. I want to trade.
Joan had thought Aaron would fit in perfectly here. He didn't. Beside Ying, Aaron looked uptight and overthought. In here, he was as out of place as Joan. My apologies, but you'll have to wait, Ying said. His accent was Oxford. There are people ahead of you in the queue. Aaron's cheeks reddened. He opened his mouth and then clearly couldn't bring himself to say it. Joan restrained herself from rolling her eyes. He and I are here together, she said. Ying had the face of a man who'd seen everything, but Joan saw a glimmer of curiosity in his eyes. A Hunt and an Oliver together? How very Romeo and Juliet. The flush crawled down Aaron's neck like an ugly rash. Not that kind of together. He looked as though he'd eaten something he was allergic to. Joan felt her irritation flicker like a fanned flame. Aaron had a knack for making her feel that way, it seemed. She bunched her hair into her fist to cool her own neck. As she did, the woman made a small, surprised cry.
You've been cut! She said to Joan. My goodness, what happened to you?
She touched her own slim side. Joan dropped her hand. The skirt had slipped, and the bandage with it, revealing the edge of the sword wound. Joan wrenched her skirt up, wishing she were wearing more than the dog vest.
What happened? The woman asked. It looks as though you were in a duel. Joan caught Aaron's alarmed look. Apparently, questions about sword wounds were dangerous territory. It's nothing, Joan said. It's just paint. Paint? The woman sounded skeptical. Ying's smooth voice interjected. My apologies. There was a wet painting by the wall. Oh, the woman said, uncertain now. Shall I have your piece delivered to the Ritz? That would be convenient, the woman said. She inclined her head graciously. Joan could feel her curious eyes on them as Ying gestured for them to follow him. Ying led them on a winding path through the gallery. The angled walls reminded Joan uncomfortably of the maze at Holland House. Her heart stuttered each time they turned a corner. She half expected to find Nick's people waiting with weapons. But at the end of their walk, there was just a small staff kitchen. It was incongruously cozy compared with the soaring gallery. Everything was covered in mismatched, striped wool. The teapot, the legs of the chairs, knife handles, cushions. My niece likes to knit, Ying said when he saw Joan looking. He went to a cabinet and took out a first aid kit. He cut off a piece of clear tape. You lied for me, Joan said, accepting the tape. I didn't lie, Ying said. There is a wet painting by the wall. His eyes crinkled slightly, although the rest of his face remained solemn. Joan did smile, tentatively. She fixed her bandage, hiding it again under the edge of the skirt. As she did, Ying put together bowls of love letter wafers and fresh strawberries and shelled peanuts. With some careful jigsaw puzzling, he squeezed all the food onto a tray. The impulse to feed guests reminded Joan acutely of Dad. Please, Ying gestured for Joan and Aaron to follow. He led them through the back door to a beautiful, if overgrown, courtyard garden. It seemed to be the centre of the Liu's residence, a square surrounded on all sides by buildings. A covered walkway ran between the courtyard and the buildings. One covered section had been set up for a painter, with a table and an easel. Ying placed the tray on the table. His niece had been here too. The table legs wore striped tights in mismatched colours, blue and red and green and pink. Joan caught Aaron glancing at them with mild horror. The courtyard had a pleasantly casual feeling. Fern fronds encroached on the table. The air smelled of paint and jasmine. The sun had come out, turning the air thick and summery. There was no sign of yesterday's storm. In the covered walkway, most of the doors had sneakers and flip-flops outside them. There were half-painted landscapes and portraits propped against the walls. One of my son's works, Ying said, and Joan realized that she'd been looking at the nearest painting. It was of a man standing outside the door of a little townhouse, his back to the viewer. Jamie loves the hero myths, Ying said. The hero myths? Joan said. The hero knocks, Aaron murmured, as if it were a familiar subject of art. Joan was more shaken than she'd have expected. Nick? The painting showed the hero standing outside a monster's door. Even from behind, he didn't look much like Nick. He had light brown hair to Nick's dark and an immense muscularity to Nick's human frame. Joan had thought she'd understood that the boy she'd kissed at Holland House was a figure from legend. But seeing him like this, mythologized in a time before his own birth, made the hairs rise on the back of her neck. Joan, Aaron said. Joan blinked at him. Yeah. She pulled herself away from the painting with some effort. Please, Ying said. Sit. There were no proper chairs in the courtyard. Joan sat on the raised brick edge of a bed of violets.
The brick was warm and dry. Ying sat on a low stool by the painter's easel. Aaron remained standing, leaning against one of the thick white pillars that separated the courtyard from its corridor. Ying poured hot water into the teapot. The scent of green leaves made Joan feel acutely homesick, as did the little teacups he unstacked. The cups were decorated with multicolored birds. They had sweeping tail feathers and outstretched wings. Phoenixes. "I've been wondering," Aaron said to Ying from his place at the pillar. "You identified our families just by looking at us." It was a detail that Joan hadn't noticed. "A Hunt and an Oliver. How did you know that?" "Most monsters are recorded in the Liu family records," Ying said matter-of-factly. "The two of you are Joan Chang Hunt and Aaron Oliver. Joan is the daughter of Pei Wen Chang, a human, and Maureen Hunt, the estranged daughter of Dorothy Hunt." Estranged? That wasn't right. Everything else was, though. Joan folded her arms, feeling exposed and in awe at the demonstration of the Liu family power. Perfect memory. "And you," Ying said to Aaron, "are the youngest son of Edmund Oliver." It wasn't a question, and Aaron didn't answer. "By Edmund's second wife," Ying said, "Marguerite Nightingale. The wife they executed." "That's enough," Aaron said tightly. His back was very stiff. His mother had been executed? Joan forced her eyes from his face. She felt as though she were intruding on something horribly private. "As I said, the Liu records are very comprehensive," Ying said. "But you didn't come here for me to tell you things you already know. You came here to bargain. So let's bargain. What is it that you want?"
"Information," Joan said.
Ying inclined his head in acknowledgement. "Rules first, then. My family likes to keep things simple. We will have a conversation, and at the end of it, my family will be owed one favour."
"What favour?" Joan said.
"You'll know when we call it in," Ying said. By the pillar, Aaron shrugged slightly at Joan. He had apparently been expecting these sorts of terms. Joan didn't like them at all. Buying something unknown for an unknown price was a stupid thing to do. But there'd been no other leads, and if she could get any information to save her family... She nodded at Ying. "Very well, then." Ying leaned over to the table and poured tea into the little cups. He passed one to Aaron and one to Joan. "What do you want to know?" Joan sipped her tea, giving herself a moment to collect herself. The tea was good, grassy and fresh and green, the kind of tea Dad kept in the freezer. "We've heard rumours," she said, "about your family's power."
"Perfect memory," Ying said. "That's common knowledge."
"There are rumours about hidden aspects of the power."
"I've heard rumours," Ying said thoughtfully, "about hidden aspects of the Oliver power."
To Aaron, he said,
"They say that the heads of your family can see more than other Olivers see."
For some reason, Aaron's gaze flicked to Joan, his expression unreadable.
"We're not talking about my family," he said.
"No," Ying said musingly.
"Oliver's see, Hunt's hide, Novak's live, Patel's bind, Portelli's open, Hathaway's leash, Nightingale's take, Tawali's keep, Argent's sway, Ali's seal, Griffith's reveal, but only the Liu's remember." The words were slightly chanted, the recital of a nursery rhyme. "The 12 great families of London," he said. "I hope you're not expecting us to pay for that," Aaron said dryly. "Every monster child in London knows that rhyme." Ying's face did that thing again, where he seemed amused without actually smiling. The family powers are common knowledge, he said. But you're asking about family secrets. If I were you, I'd be concerned that a Liu family secret would cost more than you're willing to pay.
I'm the one making the bargain, Joan said. She was the one who'd wanted to come here, not Aaron, and I'm willing to pay.
Ying gave her a long look, as if assessing whether she really wanted to make the trade. Have you ever heard of the Zhenshe de Li Shu? He said, finally.
The true history, Aaron said.
Ying's eyebrows went up. You know Mandarin?
No, Aaron said. I know of the belief. He sounded disapproving.
Ying turned back to Joan. Some people believe that there was once another timeline, he explained. One that existed before our own. Some families call it the Vera Historia, or the true timeline. There was a sad reverence in his voice. We believe that the true timeline was erased and that this timeline was created in its place. A fringe belief, Aaron said. Everyone knows that the timeline corrects itself. It's impossible for there to have ever been another timeline. Some of my family believe they remember fragments of it, Ying said. Joan's breath caught. It was true, then. The Liu's did remember changed events. Do you? She asked. Do you remember it? Ying took a long moment to answer. The Liu power is perfect memory, he said. For some of us, our power goes beyond that. We remember small changes, the ordinary fluxes of the timeline. But only those of great power have glimpsed the Zhenshe, the Li Shu. Joan leaned forward, eager. If there were another timeline, then something changed it, or someone. I'm sorry, Ying said, not unkindly, but that completes our conversation. I've given you information about the Liu power. Now you owe a favor. No, Joan said. The conversation was just starting. She needed to know so much more. How was the timeline changed? Please, I'll owe another favor. I'm sorry, Ying said. He refilled Joan's tea. As I told you, my family likes to keep things simple. One debt is simple. Multiple debts are complicated. But please, finish your tea and feel free to peruse the gallery afterward. Aaron shifted from the white pillar. He came over to sit beside Joan on the edge of the garden bed. Joan, he said softly, he's met the terms of the bargain. We can't leave, Joan said. She was sure that Ying knew more. Aaron, I can't leave until I know. Aaron bowed his head. When he raised it again, it was to look up at Ying. I'll take on a debt, he said. No, Joan said. That wouldn't be fair. He hadn't even wanted to come here. Maybe Ying would take something other than a favor. But what did Joan have to trade? She hadn't brought anything with her into this time, except for her phone and her clothes. And she'd sold the phone yesterday. The only thing she still had was... She put her hand to her chest, feeling the lines of the necklace under the soft fuzz of her jumper. The man at the market had offered to buy it yesterday, and Joan had refused. Her hands shook as she unclasped it. It was the last thing she had left of Gran. She tried not to think about that as she offered it to Ying. Will you take this instead of a favor?
I'm sorry, Ying said.
Please, Joan said, please. I need to know.
Need to know what?
Ying said. How to undo deaths. The sad lines in Ying's face were like carvings in wood.
You've lost someone.
Yes, Joan whispered.
I can't help you with what you want to know, Ying said gently. You don't owe me for telling you that you can't bring them back.
Joan couldn't accept that.
Something or someone changed the timeline before, she said. You have perfect memory, and you said that the Liu records are comprehensive. You must have heard something, some rumor, some whisper about how it was done.
She held out the necklace again.
Please.
Ying started to shake his head as if to refuse one final time. And then he frowned, leaning closer to get a better look at the necklace. Joan heard his breath catch.
Where did you get that? He said softly.
Joan remembered the way Gran's hand had slipped from her wrist, leaving the chain behind. She'd barely been able to see it through her tears that night.
My grandmother gave it to me.
May I? Ying said. But instead of reaching for the necklace, he cleared the table, moving bowls and plates to the ground so that there was only the black tray left. Joan draped the necklace across it. The gold pendant was very bright against the black. There'd been blood on the chain after Gran had died. Joan had washed it that night in the shower, but she hadn't really looked at it. She hadn't been able to bear it. Now she examined the pendant. It wasn't the silver-tongued fox of the hunts, but something else. At first, Joan couldn't make out the intention of it. It was a creature with a lion's head and the talons of a bird. It wasn't much bigger than her thumbnail, but it was exquisitely detailed, three-dimensional and lifelike. It stood on a flat gold disc, ears up, head tilted in curious interest. The whole thing seemed to be solid gold.
I never noticed you wearing that, Aaron said to Joan.
It has a long chain, Ying said absently. The chain was gold, too, and very fine. There were dark marks along it, as if the gold had been burned. Ying spread his fingers, touching four fingertips to the patches, and Joan had a sudden, clear memory of touching the chain in those same places. The chain had been unblemished, and after she'd touched it, these dark patches had appeared. She thought at the time that the blemishes had been blood, but looking at the chain now, it seemed almost as if the gold itself had been transformed into something else. But how? Ying looked at Joan again. There was something searching in his gaze, as if she hadn't really had his attention before this, and now she had it completely. Joan was unexpectedly reminded of the way Edmund Oliver had looked at her in the guilt room. His indifference had changed to interest, as if he'd seen something inside her.
What do you want to know? Ying said.
Joan swallowed. Her heart was beating faster, and she wasn't sure why.
How was the timeline changed? She asked.
There are stories about the creation of our timeline, Ying said, but they're myths.
Myths, Joan said.
The human hero is a mythical figure, Ruth had said last night.
What myths?
They say that the king created our timeline, Ying said, using an object, a device. He destroyed the Zhenshe Delisha with it, and created this timeline in its place. Now this timeline is his timeline. Everything in it is just as he wishes it to be.
What device? Joan said.
They were so close to learning what she needed to know. If there was a way to get her family back, she had to have it.
All I can tell you is that it's held at a place called the Monster Court.
Ying was still looking at her with that new attention. The seat of the king's power. And you don't need to ask me how to get to it. He picked up the necklace and, to Joan's surprise, placed it back into her hand, coiling it slowly before letting the end drop.
You have a key.
Joan stared at him. Ying stood up.
We'll call on you when we need a favor, he said.
Chapter 12. Joan and Aaron walked away from the Liu family gallery. Joan couldn't stop touching the necklace Gran had given her. Could it actually be a key to the monster court, the seat of the king's power?
You talked about the king when we first arrived, Joan said to Aaron as they walked.
Get that pendant out of sight, Aaron said, clipped. He was very tense. He'd insisted on walking back by a different route, and now he was checking over his shoulder.
Why didn't Ying take it? Joan wondered.
She tucked it carefully under her jumper. I offered it to him.
He probably didn't want it anywhere near him, Aaron said, and neither do I.
They reached an intersection. Joan pressed the button at the lights. Aaron's fingers twitched, as if standing still were intolerable.
Why are you so scared? Joan asked him.
We need to get back to the market, Aaron said. His mouth was tight, and the pale press of his lips reminded Joan of how ill he'd looked when Ruth had spoken of seeing court guards at the hospital.
Who is he king of? Joan said. All the monsters of England?
Aaron didn't seem to want to answer. When he did, it was curt. Our borders don't match what you think of as countries, he said shortly. They were drawn in a different time.
What you'd think of as countries?
Joan had that feeling again of seeing a crack through a curtain, a glimpse of another world. There was so much she didn't know, so much Gran had never told her. A red Royal Mail van trundled past them. Aaron tracked it until it had turned the corner. He was watching every car that passed. The lights changed. Come on, Aaron said. He'd already started walking.
Aaron, Joan said. Keep walking, Aaron said.
He waited for Joan to catch up.
The king is never seen, he said, still curt.
He rules through the members of the monster court, the king's arms and executioners. We sometimes call them the Curia Monstrorum.
Joan matched her pace to Aaron's. She tried to make sense of the pieces she had. The monster world had a hierarchy of authority. Ruth had talked about court guards. Joan guessed they were something like police officers. Above them were the members of the monster court, and above them, the king himself.
The king is never seen.
Joan imagined an invisible presence that permeated the monster world.
Do you think it could be true? She asked Aaron. What Ying said, do you think the king once changed the timeline? Do you think he erased the true timeline with a device?
Aaron shot another reflexive look over his shoulder.
Don't say things like that, he hissed.
He caught Joan's confused expression.
True timeline, he clarified.
Don't say those words in public. They were walking alone beside the road, hardly public, and Ying hadn't seemed afraid to say them.
No one can hear us, Joan said.
Aaron looked around before he spoke, and when he did, his voice was soft, as if he was afraid they might be overheard, even though there was clearly no one in earshot.
There is only one timeline, the king's timeline, he said. Events are just as he wishes them to be. To speak of another timeline, to call it the true timeline, it's dangerous.
It's blasphemy.
Blasphemy? Joan repeated. It was an unexpected word for the context. She would have thought treason would be a better fit for a king. But Aaron, if...
Please, Aaron ground out. Please, can you wait until we're somewhere safe before you ask any more questions?
He ran a shaky hand through his hair.
What have we got ourselves into? He asked, almost to himself.
The Ravencroft market was busier than it had been when they had left. As they wove through it, Joan finally saw how the main area was structured, divided into periods like the sections of a department store.
Over there was the 20th century, and over here, the 21st, the clothes becoming less and less familiar in colour and cut with each decade after Joan's own, until they were as strange as clothes from the distant past. It made Joan want to walk through to the far end of the market to see the contraband technologies there.
"There are court guards patrolling the market," Aaron murmured. "Keep your head down."
He ducked his own head, but Joan was curious enough to look around.
Monster police, she thought.
She remembered again Ruth's story of seeing court guards at the hospital. She didn't spot any of them at first, and then she turned into an aisle where a man was saying mildly to a stall owner, "Give me all the cell phones." The man wore a gold pin on his lapel, a winged lion posed as if stalking the viewer, wings outstretched like a bird of prey. The stall owner was a middle-aged woman with purple lipstick and a matching purple jacket. The court guard's manner was easygoing, but the woman's hands shook as she put the phones into a box. She didn't look at him directly. Aaron took Joan's elbow and moved her quickly past them. As they walked, Joan began to spot more and more guards with winged lion pins. Stall owners looked on, white-lipped but not protesting, while phones and other devices were confiscated, as their tables were stripped bare.
"Technology out of its time,"
Aaron whispered to Joan as they reached the stairs.
"Technically illegal, but court guards don't usually concern themselves with small markets like this."
Joan swallowed.
"Ruth said she saw court guards after she spoke about the massacre," she whispered, "and I was overheard speaking of the massacre yesterday. Do you think they're looking for us?"
"If they were here for us, their attention would be on people, not technology," Aaron said. "It's just a coincidental raid. Come on." To Joan's relief, Ruth opened the door to the flat on the first knock.
"There are court guards," Aaron started to say.
"I know," Ruth said. "I've been watching them from upstairs." She ushered them into the bedroom nook. There was a pull-down ladder in the ceiling. Joan followed Ruth up the ladder and found herself in a rooftop garden. On one side, the market's glass dome rose like a sail. From up here, the leadwork ravens in the blue glass were the size of cats. Waist-high parapets enclosed the rest of the rooftop, reminding Joan of the Liu family's courtyard.
"You can see everything from here," Joan said wonderingly.
Below, on the street, monsters were popping in and out of existence like soap bubbles. She didn't think she'd ever get used to that. Through the glass dome, the market was laid out in miniature. The guards looked the same as everyone else from this height, their pins too small to see. But Joan could tell where they were from the spaces other people left around them. And even from up here, Joan could see how the guards had changed the atmosphere of the market. Customers were moving more slowly, heads turned to track them. Sellers were quieter.
"No one ever comes up onto the roof," Ruth said.
"Because it's ghastly," Aaron said. Someone had put potted plants up here, but they were long dead. Withered to silver stems. The parapets were crumbling. He added, conceding, "Although true, it's a comprehensive view." Joan sat on a parapet, facing Ruth and Aaron.
"We have some news," she told Ruth.
"We spoke to Ying Liu. He confirmed the rumors. Some of the Liu's remember another timeline."
Ruth's eyes widened. "He told you that?"
"That's the least of it," Aaron said. "Your cousin is in possession of contraband from the monster court itself. Did you know that?"
"What?" Ruth said. "No."
Joan unclasped the gold necklace and leaned over to hand it to Ruth.
"Gran gave it to me just before she died."
She hoped Ruth wouldn't feel hurt that Gran had given her something. Ruth didn't look hurt. She looked puzzled. She took the necklace and stretched it out against the bright white sky. She twisted it slightly, making the chain glint.
"Have you seen it before?" Joan said. "In Gran's house, maybe? Or did she ever wear it?"
Ruth shook her head. Not that I know of. What are these dark patches on the chain? They almost look like stone.
I don't know, Joan said.
The question made her feel strangely uneasy. She remembered again how she'd touched the necklace after Gran had died, how, when she'd lifted her fingers, the gold underneath had been dull and dark. That couldn't be right, though, she thought again. She had to be remembering that wrong. For some reason, another memory came to her then. Ying Liu spreading his fingers to touch those dark patches, the way he'd looked at her searchingly afterward.
According to Ying Liu, that's a key to the monster court, Aaron said.
Ruth jumped and almost fumbled it as if he'd told her she was holding a snake.
What?
That's what he told us, Joan said. Ruth's eyes were huge. This is a key to the court, she said.
I don't understand. How is it even a key? It's a necklace.
I don't know, Aaron said. But look, the pendant is a sigil. It looks almost like a family chop.
Ruth held it up again, curiosity apparently overcoming fear.
I've never seen this sigil, she frowned, looking more closely. What is it? A gargoyle? There are knots in its tail.
A chimera of some kind, Aaron said, but I've never seen it before either.
Ruth turned the pendant over. There was an indented, stamped image on the underside of the disc, the same creature standing on a scroll.
Jones squinted at the words. Non sibi sed regi.
Latin?
Not for self, but for king, Aaron said. Those words don't belong to any of the 12 families, Ruth said.
Maybe a lesser family's chop, Aaron said, or a French family's.
But there's no name on it, Ruth said.
Oh, what's a chop? Joan asked.
Aaron reached into his pocket and took out a chain, unhooking it from a buttonhole. Joan had noticed the chain before, but she'd assumed it was for a fob watch. Now she saw that it had a little pendant figurine attached. A mermaid, but not a fairy tale mermaid. There was something menacing about the tilt of her head, her clawing hands, the snake-like coil of her tail. It was the same mermaid that had been tattooed on Aaron's relative, the same outline Joan had seen through Aaron's wet shirt. The Oliver sigil. Aaron mimed stamping it against the table and then handed it to Joan.
It's a seal.
There was a flat gold disc under the mermaid's tail. It had an etched image of the mermaid along with Aaron's name in mirrored letters. Son of Edmund, the chop said. Joan made out a Latin phrase. Fidelis ad mortem.
Proof of identity, Aaron said. Most monsters have one. In my family, we get them when our power stabilizes, when we're confirmed to be Olivers. We're buried with them when we die.
Proof of identity, Joan said. Don't people forge them?
Not really, Ruth said. They're handmade. The little scratches and imperfections are almost impossible to perfectly forge.
Joan took Gran's necklace back from Ruth. She examined it. Ruth was right. It did kind of look like a chop.
Ying told us something else, she said to Ruth as she fastened it back on. He said that the king erased the previous timeline and created this timeline in its place.
Are you talking about the true timeline? Ruth said.
At Aaron's wince, Ruth said, it's only blasphemy if you believe all that nonsense about the king being infallible.
Some of us honour our oaths, Aaron said.
Oh, give me a break from that fake Oliver piety, Ruth said.
Your family is a bunch of slithering schemers. You should just own it instead of pretending loyalty to the king.
Fidelis ad mortem, Aaron said. We live by it. You wouldn't understand.
Yes, loyal unto death, Ruth said. Clever that you don't say who you're loyal to. Everyone knows it's only to yourselves. Better than the hunt motto. What is it again? Always running. Always free, Ruth said sharply.
Can we go back to the important part of this conversation? Joan said.
Aaron closed his mouth over whatever insult he'd been about to shoot at Ruth. He shrugged one shoulder, not quite sheepish.
Ying Liu said that the king erased the previous timeline using a device, Joan told Ruth. A device kept at the monster court. Joan tapped the pendant. And now we have a way in.
She looked at the other two expectantly. Ruth was as silent as Aaron.
Gran knew about the hero, Joan said. That's why she gave me that necklace, so we could get into the court, so we could find that device and stop the massacre.
You want to break into the monster court, Aaron said.
Yes, of course, Joan said.
You want to steal a device from the king, Aaron said. The mythical device that he used to create the kingdom he ruled over. The device that, if it existed, he would protect more closely than any object in his possession.
I didn't say it would be easy.
Aaron laughed. Joan, the court isn't even reachable. It sits outside time. There's no way to get there without an invitation and an escort.
Well, maybe that's what the necklace is for, Joan said. Maybe it's not exactly a key. Maybe it's an invitation.
I don't want to have this stupid conversation, Aaron said. Getting in and out isn't even the issue. We'd be executed on the spot if we were even overheard speaking of this. What we need to do is to lie low, find a safe place to stay, and settle down in this time.
Settle down in this time? Joan said, incredulous. She thought about Aaron's list. Housing, school.
Yes, Aaron said, and he was actually being serious about it. Joan couldn't believe it. Our families were murdered, he said. We were nearly killed too. We experienced something truly horrendous. We need to stop and take a breath.
Gran gave me this necklace for a reason, Joan said.
You don't know that, Aaron said, sounding as frustrated as Joan felt. Dorothy Hunt is a renowned thief. She probably stole it without even knowing what it was.
She told me we had to stop the hero, Joan said. She gave me that necklace to use it. She knew.
And was there a reason why she never told you anything else your whole life? Aaron said. Was there a reason she waited until she was dying to tell you anything at all?
We're not talking about that, Jane said. Couldn't he see that they might have found a way to save their families?
We need to make a plan to get into the monster court.
We're not going to the monster court, Aaron said, just as impatiently.
We're never going to the court.
I'll go without you if I have to.
Oh, really? How are you going to do that? How are you even going to find it? I wouldn't know how to find it. Aaron turned to Ruth. Maybe your family should have actually taught her something. Then she wouldn't have such stupid ideas about things.
Will you shut up about that? Joan snapped.
No, Aaron said. You almost fell out of this time twice yesterday.
To Ruth, he said, that should never have happened. Your family never even taught her to be safe.
Gran wouldn't let us tell her what monsters were, Ruth blurted, as if surprised into honesty.
What? Joan felt as though she'd been punched. Ruth saw her expression.
Oh, Joan, it's not like we just thought you couldn't travel.
Most monsters can't if they have a human parent.
Gran probably thought it would be kinder if you didn't know. I mean,
her voice gentled. I suppose she thought it would upset you too much to learn the truth of it.
But, Joan blinked, puzzlement overriding hurt for a moment. Gran had known that Joan could travel. Gran had known to wait up for Joan the night she first traveled. She'd known.
You must have known I could. Aren't there records?
But that's what I mean, Ruth said. The record said you couldn't travel.
You thought she wasn't a monster, Aaron said.
I didn't say that, Ruth said. A person who can't travel isn't a monster.
Is that what you say about Olivers who can't?
Ruth sounded disgusted. An Oliver who can't travel is an oxymoron, Aaron said. Your family makes me sick, Ruth said.
Joan found herself standing. Her head was starting to hurt. She needed to think.
Where are you going? Aaron said suddenly.
For a walk.
A walk where?
Ruth asked.
I need to think.
And she couldn't do that with all their bickering.
Joan left the monster street and walked until her head started to clear. She needed to find out how the key worked and where the court was. Maybe she should go back to the Lewes. The sun was out. She tipped her head up to feel it. She waited for some sniping comment from Aaron about the pause, but it didn't come. She'd forgotten for a second that she was alone. The silence gave her a strange feeling of relief and, unexpectedly, something closer to loneliness. There were cafes all along the street. Joan picked an American-style diner with big windows and seats that got a bit of sun. Inside, tired tourists were eating hamburgers and hot dogs and all-day breakfast sausages and eggs. Joan sorted through her money, carefully separating the monster notes from the human ones. When the waiter came, she ordered a pot of tea. Then she sat there, leaning her head back against the headrest and watching a couple argue over a map the size of a tablecloth. In 30 years, they'd have GPS and nothing to argue over. The waiter returned with tea.
Thanks, Joan said as he set it down. Then, to her surprise, he slid into the seat opposite hers. Her heart stopped. It was Nick.
Chapter 13. Nick's hands shot out before Joan could react, clamping around both her wrists. Joan's heart pounded painfully. She heard the catch of her own breath. He looked just the same as he had 2 nights ago. The night she'd kissed him. The night her family had been murdered. His dark eyes were just the same, serious and earnest, just like when he'd asked her to stay with him.
Do you remember what I told you the last time I saw you? He said.
He'd told her he'd kill her if she ever stole time again. A shot of fear went through her. She tested the underside of the table with her knee. It didn't budge, even when she increased the pressure. She glanced at the neighboring table. It was bolted down. She couldn't kick the table over. Nick looked casually out the window. People were walking past them, dressed for work, in the loose suits of this time. Joan followed his eyes from the window to the security camera above them, to another camera on the other side of the room.
Next time, he said, still soft, I'll make sure we're alone.
How can you be here? Joan whispered. But there was only one way. And like a storm hitting, her shock and fear at seeing him gave way to pure fury. You're a monster too. After all you did, you're...
No. Nick's jaw tightened. I'm human.
You liar, Joan said. He was too good at lying. Everything he said was clear-eyed and true. Only monsters can travel.
Only monsters and me. And I travel in a different way. I don't steal time.
How then? He didn't answer, and Joan shook her head in contempt. She thought about how she'd left Aaron and Ruth back at the market and couldn't believe how cavalier she'd been. If Nick's people found them, they'd be helpless.
Or maybe they were already dead. Maybe everyone at the inn and the market.
Joan wrenched at her hands. Nick's grip tightened.
Sorry. He said. He didn't sound sorry. I can't let you touch me.
It was unbearable to be this close to him, to look at his familiar face, his serious eyes. Joan had looked at him so much at the house. She imagined what they must seem like to anyone glancing at them from the outside. A boy holding his girlfriend's hands at lunch. A few days ago, she'd have wanted that so much. Now they both knew that if he loosened his grip, she'd fly for his neck, cameras or not.
One question had been burning in her mind since that night. Did you know they were my family before you had them killed? No. Nick's eyes were still clear. Joan made herself keep going. Would you have killed them if you'd known? Nick didn't hesitate. Yes. It hurt like a physical wound. We were friends. You and me, we were... Her voice broke. He'd kissed her. She'd never kissed anyone before. Why did you have to kill them? Why did you have to? She could hardly recognize her own voice. The worst of it was that she felt it still, the pull toward him. I hate you, she said. This time, Nick did hesitate, long enough for Joan to hear his hitched exhale. I know. Joan wanted to kick the table over. She wanted to hurt Nick like he'd hurt her. You didn't have to kill them, she said. You didn't even know them. They were people. You're killing people. They were stealing time from humans. His brown eyes were still earnest. I couldn't allow them to harm anyone else. Joan couldn't bear the earnestness. She couldn't bear being on the other side of it. You killed all those people, she said. You didn't even give them a chance. And now those solemn eyes hardened. You're wrong, he said. Every monster who died that night had stolen time. Every member of your family. The Olivers, the other families. His voice went cold. You know who didn't get a chance. The humans they stole from. All those people on the tube. The tourists of London. People just walking down the street. Your people prey on them. But not anymore. I won't allow humans to be harmed. We won't be prey. He'd never been prey. He'd seemed so vulnerable in the guilt room, a boy among monsters, and all that time, he'd been the deadliest thing there. Hello, a cheerful voice said. Joan jumped, startled. It was a waitress. Joan had almost forgotten that they were in public. Oh, I didn't mean to scare you, love. The waitress had a Welsh accent and kind eyes. She pulled out a notepad and pen. Her name tag was cloud-shaped and said Donna. What would you like? She said. We do breakfast all day. Bit of toast, eggs. Everything on the menu's good except for the porridge. Chef did something fancy with a grapefruit peel and nutmeg today. I'd avoid it. Nick shifted subtly, changing his grip on Joan, making it look more like they were holding hands. His posture changed too, loosening out of dangerous into something gentler. If it hadn't been for the tension in his jaw, the sharpness in his eyes, Joan might have thought he was the Nick she'd known, the volunteer she'd met in the Holland House Library. She fought back a pang. That Nick had never existed. Joan was missing someone who'd never been real. Donna looked at their clasped hands and smiled as if they looked sweet sitting there together. What can I get you? She said. Joan made herself smile back. Might need a bit longer. Donna's neck was bare. Joan found herself hunching, wanting to cover her own neck in sympathy. But Donna didn't know that monsters were real, that another London existed within her own. She didn't know that people could steal life from her just by touching her neck, and that this sweet-seeming boy was capable of a massacre. Sorry, Nick said to Donna apologetically. I need a minute too. Sandwiched out of Donna's view, one of his hands had clamped down harder in Joan's wrists, grinding down, almost painful. He thought he was protecting Donna from her, Joan realized, and a wave of anger hit her again. All right then. Donna said, still cheerful. I'll be over there. Just give me a yell. They watched her walk back to the counter. If you touch anyone in this room, Nick murmured, I'll risk the cameras. Joan dropped all pretense of smiling. I'm not the one responsible for a massacre. Now that Joan had seen a glimpse of the old Nick again, she could see something of him still in this new incarnation. The two Nicks shared a kind of serious quality, a calmness that Joan had found peaceful at the house. She'd been on a school excursion once to a chapel built in the first century. They'd all been allowed to touch the rough stone wall of it, 2,000 years old and still standing, utterly solid, while everything around it had fallen. Joan had imagined its foundation stretching miles down into the earth. When she'd first met Nick, she'd been oddly reminded of that wall. This new Nick had that quality too, but in him, it just felt like implacability. Now she knew why. He had a mission, and nothing would alter it. He wouldn't stop hunting monsters until everyone was dead.
If you're not here to kill me, then what do you want? Joan gritted out. Nick's eyes traveled down her neck. Joan flushed.
That's a nice necklace, he said. Joan wrenched at her hands, but it was like tugging at a wall. Nick adjusted his grip so that he was holding her wrists with one hand and then slipped a finger under the chain. He tugged until the pendant slipped out from under Joan's shirt. He made a sound that wasn't quite amused, just a soft huff of air.
I looked for this at the house, he said.
And Joan remembered the audit he'd been doing, cataloguing every object in every room. Joan thought about how Gran had given her the necklace with the last of her strength. She thought about Ying's widening eyes when he'd seen it.
You were looking for this all along, she said.
And you had it all along, Nick said.
I'd never have guessed.
He turned the pendant, his knuckles brushed against Joan's throat. She swallowed involuntarily and knew he'd felt it when he lifted his eyes to hers.
I never guessed you were a monster, he said. I watched over you at the house. I thought I was keeping you safe.
He ran his thumb over the little pendant and his forehead creased. I never thought you were one of them. It hurt unexpectedly. She hadn't even known what monsters were until that last day with him. Was it hard, killing all those people? She asked. Did you feel anything?
I did what had to be done, Nick said.
And who was the new Nick completely when he said it, his gaze hard, dangerous.
Is that what you tell yourself to sleep at night? Joan said.
Something flickered over Nick's face.
Oh.
You don't sleep, she said.
I haven't much either since that night.
Where did you find the necklace? He said.
What is it? Joan countered. He shrugged.
A gold necklace with a charming elfin pendant. Made in the mid-19th century, I'd guess.
What's at the monster court?
His posture stiffened.
He pulled the chain gently until he found the clasp. His fingers worked, and then the chain and pendant were in